Welcome, everybody, to this Haven Center and Progressive Magazine presentation this evening, Resistance in the Age of Trump. My name is Norman Stockwell. I'm the publisher of the Progressive Magazine, and hopefully on the way in you grabbed a copy of our latest issue. They're available there for free. Please take one along. It's got a bunch of great stuff. Our speaker tonight, David Barsamian, is a regular contributor to The Progressive, and his interviews have been published in book form out of the magazine as well. I have to start by making an apology to those of you that had not heard the news yet, but Tariq Ali had an accident on his way to come here, and he hurt his ankle getting on the train to come here and had to cancel his flight. And is unable to attend tonight, but we're hoping that he'll be back in January to talk to you all and to receive his award. So that's the plan. And if you keep looking at havencenter.org on the internet, you'll be able to catch up with the plans for that. Speaking of the Haven Center, they have another great program coming up in just a few weeks, October 31st through November 2nd. David Bacon, longtime labor organizer and excellent photographer, is going to be here talking about what we might describe as the immigration side of what David will be talking about tonight and the effects of the Trump administration on immigration in this country. David Bacon, also a regular contributor to the Progressive Magazine, and we had a wonderful spread of his photos a couple issues back. One other lecture that I should let you know about is coming up in November 9th, Kathy Kelly, a world-renowned peace activist nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize. Kathy Kelly is going to be in Madison on November 9th, which is a Thursday night, speaking at Edgewood College. I don't have the room location here, but you can check that out on the Edgewood College website. Well, it's a great pleasure for me to be able to introduce our speaker tonight. David Barsamian has altered the independent media landscape, both with his weekly radio show, Alternative Radio, now in its 32nd year, and with his books with Noam Chomsky, Iqbal Ahmed, Howard Zinn, Tariq Ali, Richard Wolff, Arundhati Roy, and Edward Said. His forthcoming books are with Noam Chomsky and Arundhati Roy, and that Noam Chomsky book will be out next month. It's part of a series of four books, this new one is on global discontents. David regularly lectures on world affairs, imperialism, capitalism, propaganda, and the media, the economic crisis, and global rebellions. He's the winner of the Media Education Award, the ACLU's Upton Sinclair Award for Independent Journalism, and the Cultural Freedom Fellowship from the Lannan Foundation. The Institute for Alternative Journalism named him one of its top 10 media heroes, and he's the recipient of the Lifetime Achievement Award from the Rocky Mountain Peace and Justice Center. I should also note that David was recently deported from India for his work on Kashmir and is still banned from traveling to the world's largest democracy. When I was last in Boulder, Colorado, visiting David in June of last year, we strolled down the Pearl Street Mall and I bought this hat. Award in his honor tonight. Without further ado, and I also want to thank Brian Alberth, who's videotaping tonight's presentation, which will be available through the Haven Center website as well at a later date. So without further ado, I'd like to give a warm welcome to our guest tonight, David Barsamian.
Thank you very much, Norman, and good evening, Madison. Ahlan wa sahlan, khush amadid, bienvenido, ramatsek, khush geldeniz, swagatam. Welcome in multiple languages some of you who may speak those languages. I'm not Tariq Ali, but I'm going to try and say or capture some of the things and interests that motivate him. And it's an odd situation because just last month I was to speak on a panel in Vancouver, and the featured speaker, who happens to be a very distinguished peace activist from India, had to cancel because he had a heart attack. And I was drafted to be then the keynote speaker for this conference in Vancouver. And again, alas, just a few days ago, Patrick and Norman contacted me to see if I could move from my position as the interlocutor with Tariq Ali to being actually the main speaker. Before I actually start, I want to hand out a sign-up sheet so that I can keep in touch with you and you can find out about alternative radio and what's happening. You heard about the new Chomsky book, The 11th, in a series that we've been doing since the last 25 years or so. There is a condition, though, and that is please write clearly. Often when I get back to Boulder and look at some of these sheets, they're indecipherable. So just share your email. That's all I need. Don't worry, I'm not going to give it to the FBI or the NSA because they already have all your material, so you can be very comfortable. I'd like to kind of dedicate this lecture to the spirit of Howard Zinn, wonderful radical historian, author of The People's History of the United States, someone who was very close to Madison, who came here multiple times over his long career. Perhaps some of you, I can see, are even nodding, have heard Howard. And one of the things I learned from him, and I regard him as a mentor, is the use of humor in political discourse, that people can lighten up a little bit, perhaps they're a bit more receptive to the kind of indulgence that people on the left often get into with gloom and doom. The end is near, comrades. It's worse than you think. Not exactly phrases that will win a popularity contest, particularly with younger people. So I'm in the spirit of Howard Zinn, I'm going to introduce you to a certain news anchor of quite important reputation. Dun, 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 dun. We interrupt this program from Madison, Wisconsin, to bring you this breaking news story from TIBC, the Truth in Broadcasting Corporation, from our world corporate headquarters in our secure state-of-the-artless underground studios in Roswell, New Mexico. I'm Dick Veneer, your glib and banal anchor of Facade News. Facade News, the 24/7 newscast dedicated to keeping you in the dark. We go straight to the surface of a story and we stay there. No one can beat our in-shallow reporting. We are dedicated to the highest standards of journalism. We make things up as we go along, unencumbered by elitist concepts like facts and the truth. Our award-losing reporters are dedicated to giving you fake news all the time, with a thorough and scrupulous disregard for facts. Our credos, unfair and unbalanced. We deceive, you believe. Ladies and gentlemen, an amazing story coming across our news desk at this very moment. President Trump, our exalted leader, has determined that 2 and 2 is 5. He told Facade News in an exclusive interview that after much soul-searching and consultations with his daughter and son-in-law, that he now concludes that long-held views of 2 and 2 is 4 are wrong. He described the process while playing golf as amazing and unbelievable, and he added, "The people love the tremendous math that we are doing." Stay tuned for updates on this and other breaking stories right here on Facade News. I'm Dick Veneer, your still glib and banal anchor, and reminding you, believe our news or else. And now, back to our regularly scheduled program in Madison, Wisconsin. Dick Vanier and his newscast. You know, there's a breaking story actually right now that's going on that is, again, totally enshrouded in a lack of context or information, and that is about the four special forces that were killed in Niger. And, of course, there's a big brouhaha about apologies, were apologies made or not made, how were they made, etc. But what is completely left out of the discussion, particularly in the corporate media, is what are U.S. troops doing in Niger? What? You know, I challenge some of you to find Niger on the map. It's not Nigeria. That's another country in West Africa. It's a landlocked country with Algeria to the north, Nigeria to its south, and Libya to the northeast. And that's a key part of how the war, so-called endless war on terror, has extended into West Africa. It has a lot to do with U.S. Destruction and NATO destruction of Libya, and a huge proliferation, an increase in violence in that country after the overthrow of the Gaddafi dictatorship in 2012. And the country has basically split into three parts, and one offshoot, or one certainly regrettable aspect of that part of the war on terror, is that there's been a huge shipment of arms, Libyan arms, to Niger and to Nigeria. If you want to know how Boko Haram has flourished in Nigeria and has grown and expanded, it's largely through the capture of weapons resulting in the destruction of the Libyan state. Actions have consequences, and this is, of course, in 2012. Perhaps some of you know that we, the United States, I guess we should all stand when we do that, not kneel, and pledge support for our country and its great leader, that the United States has now established a special military command for Africa based in Djibouti. So U.S. troops are in Mali, they're in Somalia, they're all over Western Africa, with hardly any discussion about this new chapter in the war on terrorism. Because I'm very tall, I'll pull up my shirt here so that you can see waging war, homeland security, fighting terrorism since 1492 with four historic Native American leaders being depicted there. I just spent some time with Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz, who's the author of An Indigenous People's History of the United States, kind of the companion volume to Zinn's A People's History of the United States. And she attaches great significance to what happened at Standing Rock in terms of building a resistance. Yes, it was a defeat in the end, but it was also a victory in the bringing together of several hundred Indian nations. I don't like to use the colonial term tribes. Several hundred Indian nations overcame their various internecine squabbles and differences and united around saving the land, saving the water. And so injecting that into the public discourse, that we have an obligation to Mother Nature, that Mother Nature needs to be nurtured and protected, and that indigenous people historically have had a long-term view in terms of protecting Mother Nature is something that we can all internalize and perhaps reproduce in our own ways. So that struggle continues. It's not over. As I mentioned, I was in British Columbia just last month, and there, First Nations, that's what they call Native Americans in Canada, First Nations peoples are building small huts, cabins, along a proposed pipeline out from the tar sands in Alberta, pretty much straight through First Nations country, out to Vancouver Island, and from there supposedly to China. This is, of course, the filthiest carbon on Earth, what James Hansen, the distinguished NASA scientist, called a carbon time bomb if released, and would effectively be game over for the climate if, in fact, these tar sands are taken out of the ground. But there's a lot of pushback in Canada, and this is against Justin Trudeau, who is regarded as this bright new hope. But he too has, you know, certain political obligations to the oil, chemical, petrochemical industries in Canada, and he's going forward with this particular pipeline. Idle No More is the name of a group in Canada, largely First Nations, started in Saskatchewan, that are pushing back very, very hard on this particular issue. Now, Antonio Gramsci, who's one of my intellectual heroes, he said when a country, when a society is in decline, all kinds of morbid symptoms start appearing. And I was thinking about that recently when I found a couple of posters in Boulder, Colorado, which is, you know, a fairly liberal, progressive town, university town in the foothills of the Rockies, you know, somewhat akin to Madison, maybe half the population. And I just found these posters. I'll read a couple of them for you about maybe they represent morbid symptoms. This one is about metaphysics, technology, electronic currency, and the atmosphere of connection, progress, and unity. The expanding consciousness event of the year, exclamation point, to be held in Orlando, Florida, New World Consciousness. I guess I'll have to wait until Orlando dries out to hold that particular conference. Here's one of my favorites, Denver Near-Death Studies. Want to get in touch with the lost one you're missing terribly? Open doors, open hearts, afterlife, contact from beyond. Vicky was engaged to a man she had fallen in love with, Walt. He suddenly passed on, but yet she's able to reach him in the afterlife. So attend this particular workshop. And then, this is the gift of understatement, the greatest event in history is now unfolding. Maitreya, the teacher for all humanity, is in the world. There'll be two chances to meet Maitreya, one in Boulder and one in Denver. And just walking along State Street today, my eye was caught by this local poster saying, Meditation Crash Course. Now, somehow there's a disconnect there. I don't quite get meditation with crash, which suggests something, you know, quite calamitous and high speed. And that's just, you know, maybe a linguistic glitch. But that's right here in Madison. And then you find all kinds of magical thinking that's going on. You know, can pigs fly? Debates about that. Chemtrails. Ideas about Building 7, grassy knolls, second shooters, magic bullets, all these kinds of things that are being fed by a whole industry on the internet. If you just go to some of these sites, they're very serious discussions about what happened in this case or that case and the grand conspiracies that are going on behind the scenes that we cannot see. It was a very important book written in the 1980s by Neil Postman called Amusing Ourselves to Death. I'd like to read to you just this one paragraph. When a population becomes distracted by trivia, when cultural life is redefined as a perpetual round of entertainment, when serious public conversation becomes a form of baby talk, when, in short, a people become an audience and their public business a vaudeville act, then a nation finds itself at risk. And I think I can say with some confidence that in this time, in October of 2017, we are a nation at risk. We are led by people who believe in magical theories, for example, that carbon dioxide is not toxic, a nominee to the Environmental Protection Agency has just said that. Others who believe that coal is clean, doesn't represent any kind of threat to the environment, and will not accelerate climate. just after, you know, appointment after appointment, the most recent one is a guy named Matir, who has compared reproductive rights for women to a Nazi tactics of euthanasia, you know, killing people off who are not physically fit. Just an absurd claim, and he's being appointed to a federal court seat by Trump. There's much damage being done on this kind of lower level that we can't see of court appointments, and also appointments, as you know, this assistant secretary or this undersecretary in various government ministries. I think we cannot be, as Gore Vidal reminded us, the USA, the United States of Amnesia. We have to retain our memories. We have to remember the past as an act of resistance, because if we remember the past and know what's happened, we are able to protect ourselves and insulate ourselves from the dangers that we are now facing. As Chomsky once said, historical amnesia is dangerous not only because it undermines moral or intellectual integrity, but it lays the groundwork for further crimes. Now, I was very disturbed yesterday on my way in from the airport here in Madison to stop at the Abraham Lincoln Brigade Monument and to learn that it was vandalized in late September with the swastika, comments about the Trump rules, and other, you know, very hurtful comments. This, in the shadow of the oldest synagogue in Madison, if not in the state of Wisconsin, I believe it's called Gate of Heaven, very, very disturbing that these are the kind of impulses always lurking in the American society, but that have erupted because of the election of Donald Trump and his enabling rhetoric and the people that he's surrounded himself with. You know, of course, of the America First campaign that he launched. You know, it's really interesting, speaking of America First, I have a little bit of knowledge of it, although I'm not old enough to remember it directly, but I'm from the Upper East Side in Manhattan, called Germantown. Now it's called Yorkville. And right up until actually after the outbreak of World War II, there were Nazi marches on East 86th Street. We lived on 87th Street. On East 86th Street, there were swastikas and Heil Hitler salutes and people marching up and down praising Germany. And as we speak, Richard Spencer, who is an openly avowed neo-Nazi, he's one of the leaders of what's called the alt-right movement. And if you want to look at something scary, look at their website. I don't think we should hide from what they're saying. We should hear what they're saying and confront them with it. Very important. He may be speaking now at the University of Florida in Gainesville. The governor has declared an emergency. He's brought out the National Guard, a kind of, a really uber response to Spencer's presence. But that, you know, on the heels of dollar bills, tells you something about what's happening around the country. And again, if you read these sites, InfoWars, Alex Jones, Red State, Conservative News, and the Bannon Breitbart News, and others, you'll see all kinds of hateful comments and a huge surge in anti-Jewish slandering. They've taken Harvey Weinstein and made him kind of a poster boy for what Jews are doing to America on a larger scale. Well, America First does have a history, and it goes back to the 1930s, unbeknownst probably to Donald Trump, and that was a political movement led by Charles Lindbergh, you know, arguably the most famous American of his generation. You know, he flew to Paris on a solo flight in 1927, but he began this political party, and he visited Germany. He was very impressed with its, I'm quoting here, for its organized vitality. I have never in my life been so conscious of a directed force. It's thrilling when seen. And then in November 1939, weeks after World War II broke out in Europe, he said that the West can have peace and security only so long as we band together to preserve that most priceless possession, our inheritance of European blood. Well, that comment about blood, of course, resonates with Nazi slogans about Boden und Blut, about the soil and blood and the need to keep its purity. And then on September 11th, 1941, Lindbergh gave a huge, he gave a speech to a huge crowd in Des Moines, Iowa, in which he described the people that wanted the United States to enter the war. There were three groups, he said: the British, the government, and the Jewish race. And the Jewish race's greatest danger to this country lies in their large ownership and influence in our motion pictures, our press, our radio, and our government. And this went up right through early 1942 when the party went underground because the war had broken out and the U.S. was engaged. So knowing a little bit of history is really important. There's, you know, the famous axiom from Santayana: those who cannot remember the past are condemned to repeat it. Orwell said in 1984, who controls the past controls the future, and controls the present controls the past. And history, the past, is a battleground. It's not a collection of some neutral facts. It is deeply contested. There are literally battles over what gets into history and what gets omitted. And this is a highly charged ideological area, and we see the right wing trying to rewrite history, imagining an America that never existed. You know, like when Dick Cheney, who makes his, you know, who actually should be in Leavenworth or San Quentin or some federal prison for his war crimes against the Iraqi people and others, that's a kind of an aside. He said, you know, my ancestors came here on the Mayflower. They came to Plymouth Rock, and they found that no one was here, and they settled the country. So that myth of terra nullius, that the land was, you know, it kind of links up with the Zionist slogan of a land without people for a people without a land. Duh, there were millions of people here, native peoples, who had a very sophisticated civilization, towns and cities, all kinds of arts and crafts, agricultural development, etc. That part of American history has been conveniently swept aside, and you have heroic tales about brave pioneers, you know, fighting off these wild savages. In fact, Thomas Jefferson, who's, you know, whenever you mention a founding father, I call them the founding finaglers, you have to, like, you know, lower your voice in reverence. It was Jefferson in the Declaration of Independence who, in one of the charges against King George, called Native Americans merciless savages. Well, I think those peoples found out very quickly who the merciless savages were on this continent, as many of them were wiped out and then penned into virtual concentration camps. But again, because of what's happening now, there's a lot of resistance and pushback on those reservations, and people are coming off the reservations literally and figuratively. I'd like to mention a little bit about the Progressive magazine. Norman said a few words about it, but he's way too shy because he's the publisher. But I, as a contributor and a longtime subscriber, can tell you that it's one of the best magazines in the country, and it really deserves your support. So if you're not a subscriber, become one. You know, it's a very valuable resource, and we need to make these resources grow and expand and are rooted in a secure future so that they can continue to bring you, you know, independent perspectives, a rare commodity these days, by the way. Independent views that are progressive. You don't find a lot of them out there. And I know the holidays are coming. I've just picked up my 2018 progressive calendar. It makes for a great gift. Why don't you get a bunch of them and hand them out to your friends? And also, they're very instructive as a kind of, history lesson, what happened on this date and that date. Please support the magazine. Tune in to Alternative Radio on WIDE Monday evenings at 6. Support independent media wherever you can. Go to the website, alternativeradio.org. There's some free podcasts there, and do listen. End of commercial interruption. It was mentioned that I was banned from India. Actually, it's going on 7 years now. It happened on September 23rd, 2011. I arrived at Indira Gandhi International Airport in New Delhi. I had a valid visa. I had been in India just 6 months before. And I heard those dreaded words you never want to hear at an airport. Can you come with me? You're lucky if you get a please. And I was taken into a room. A piece of paper was waved in my face. I wasn't able to see it properly. And I was told that you're being sent back on this plane, this very same flight that you came in on that's returning to Europe. And I said, well, what is this about? And the immigration officer said, we have an order from the kind of Homeland Security Ministry, the Ministry of the Interior. The minister at that time was Chidambaram. Apparently, I was persona non grata. Why? Because I reported on one of the major human rights atrocities going on then and going on today, by the way, in Indian-occupied Kashmir. One of the legacies of the 1947 partition of the Indian subcontinent was that the question of Kashmir was never really adjudicated properly, and the wishes of the Kashmiri people, who were overwhelmingly Muslim, were ignored, and the Maharaja, the king of the state of Kashmir, Jammu and Kashmir, opted to join the Indian Union against the wishes of the majority of his people. There's been on and off sporadic warfare, guerrilla warfare, attacks, shootings. This is one of the most underreported stories that I know of. 70 to 80,000 people have been killed. Tens of thousands of Kashmiris have been arrested, tortured, scarred for life. Human rights abuses go on, constantly. And there's very little reporting on this, primarily because India, the Indian state, has been very skillful in presenting its side of the story. Said, yeah, well, there may be some people, they're troublemakers, they're from Pakistan, they're outsiders, and then here's the key word, they're all terrorists. They have no legitimate grievances. People here in Kashmir are happy, as Palestinians are happy under Israeli occupation, as other people, as the Rohingya, are happy under Burmese occupation in Myanmar, etc. This becomes the go-to word whenever states want to silence any kind of discussion or scrutiny, just label the opposition as terrorists. And incidentally, our foremost newspaper, the New York Times, reported just a couple of days ago, and I'm paraphrasing here, the Indian government says that these were outside agitators that are causing trouble. And then the key line, Kashmiris say that they are subject to brutal Indian policies. So it becomes, if you're just reading this for the first time, it becomes an opinion of the Kashmiris, not a fact. They say, like Palestinians say that they're stopped at checkpoints and are, closely examined and brutalized or whatever. They say that, but other people say they don't do that. The Israelis welcome them with, fizzy water, croissants and eclairs and things like that. So there's two sides here. You don't know, which side is telling the truth. But India itself has won the propaganda campaign, particularly against Pakistan, in they've presented the country, you know, everyone is practicing yoga and living in ashrams and are vegetarian and playing sitar and ragas deep into the night and are just, you know, the land of Buddha and Gandhi. And that's always juxtaposed with neighboring Pakistan, which is the brutal dictatorship where the army has tremendous influence and control, and it's an Islamic state. India is a secular state. Well, things have changed in India. I don't know if you're keeping up with the stories, but this admiral that I substituted for in Vancouver last month, his name is Ram Dass, he recently issued a clé de cœur to the president of India, who happens to be, his name is Ramnath Kovind. Ram Dass was in the Indian military for almost 45 years. He retired as the chief of naval staff in 1993, and he is a human rights and peace activist today. I'm just going to read a little bit from the letter that he wrote to the Indian president. Although the country has achieved a lot and made progress in certain areas, in many others we have remained backward and stuck in our age-old blind beliefs, regressive social mores, and in recent times have allowed the forces of religious hyper-nationalism to endanger the fundamental constitutional provisions and promises of a tolerant, equitable nation where there would be dignity for all and freedom of thought, speech, and expression. I fear our constitution is under attack and faces grave threats from the forces that have been let loose. Our values and traditions built and nurtured over seven decades are today threatened as never before. The increased intolerance at all levels, the shocking assault and treatment of our minority communities, especially Muslims, the growing tendency to take law into their own hands by lynch mobs and go-rakshas. Go-rakshas, go is cow in Hindi, a raksha is someone who protects the cow. The Hindutva nationalists regard the cow as holy, so that anyone that harms a cow is, in fact, has been burned to death, lynched, beaten, etc. So he's worried, and the continuing impunity which Dalits, that's to say the untouchable community, and Adivasis, the original inhabitants of South Asia and the Indian subcontinent, they and their women are targets of physical, sexual, and verbal abuse and attacks that bring no credit to our heritage and tradition. The age-old principles of dignity and respect have almost totally given way to a barely concealed right to those with money and power to do as they will, and corruption in all these many forms has increased across the board. Now, what are these forces that have been unleashed that Admiral Ram Dass has talked about? And this gives you some context for what's going on in our country, the rise of right-wing power. In 2014, the BJP, which is the acronym Bharatiya Janata Party, the Indian People's Party, a Hindutva political organization, the hyper-Hindu nationalist organization, swept into power, and it's selected as its prime minister Narendra Modi, who has a history. He has a history as a member of the RSS, which is the equivalent, I would say, to kind of like the Hitler Youth. They modeled themselves in the 1920s after Hitler and Mussolini. They wore brown shirts and short khaki pants, and they went around terrorizing Muslims. They believed in that India meant Hindu India. It didn't mean any of the other communities living in the country, such as Parsis from Iran, Zoroastrian, Jains, Buddhists, Muslims, of course. India has one of the largest Muslim populations on earth. They did not feel that there was any room in the country for these other groups. And Modi was a member of the RSS. Now, you imagine someone, maybe we can, imagine a president of the United States being elected who had been a member of the KKK? Well, this is what has happened in India. Modi was a member of this extreme right-wing organization, and he's never apologized, nor has he renounced his membership in the RSS, an acronym for a very long term in Sanskrit that I won't bore you with. So this Modi, when he was chief minister of the state of Gujarat, ironically the home state of Mahatma Gandhi, presided over a major massacre of Muslims in 2002, where people were, women were raped, burned alive. The kinds of stories we're hearing now actually about what's happening to the Rohingya in Myanmar, babies being ripped from their mothers and being thrown up in the air and bayoneted, women being raped en masse, and men being executed, beheaded, and brutalized in the most horrible ways. But this was happening in the world's largest democracy while Modi was the chief minister of the state. Now, we know from testimony of from survivors and others that the Hindu mobs went from house to house, from store to store, and knew exactly which ones were Muslim and which ones were Hindu. So remarkably, the Hindu stores and shops and apartments and houses were not damaged, and all the Muslim houses and apartments and stores were attacked and vandalized, and the people driven from them. That could only have happened with state connivance. They had the printout sheets of where the people were and what their names were. And so when Modi claimed at the time that he didn't know what was going on, either he's a bald-faced liar or he's incredibly incompetent. And the United States government, under that radical leftist George W. Bush, in 2005, actually banned Modi from visiting the United States. He wanted to come. He was being invited by some right-wing Hindu groups here in the U.S., and the State Department, under Bush, would not issue him a visa because of his involvement in the massacre of Muslims just a few years before. Now he was welcomed by Donald Trump. They embraced, almost kissed. They gave bear hugs, and Trump declared that India was a strategic partner. Arms deals were signed. That, of course, is, I think, the main criterion for U.S. policymakers to describe an ally is the extent of the military contract that they get. So India is now one of the largest procurers of U.S. weapons, as is that other great democracy, Saudi Arabia, where the first country that our exalted leader visited earlier this year. Remember, he did his little saber dance. Did you like those moves? Very impressive. Not a word about human rights violations in Saudi Arabia, not a word about the atrocities that the Saudi Air Force has been carrying out in Yemen, which has reduced large parts of that country to rubble, resulting in the deaths of tens of thousands, mostly civilians, and crucially, blockading Yemeni ports and not allowing the import of badly needed food and medicine. And mind you, before this even started, Yemen was the poorest of the 22 Arab states. It may be the first country on earth to actually run out of fresh water. It is a critically water-stressed area. And so, in fact, this is a major issue throughout West Asia and South Asia. Contrary to what you may hear from Donald Trump and EPA Administrator Scott Pruitt, climate change is happening. Temperatures are going through the roof. Last year in Kuwait and Saudi Arabia and in Iraq, there were temperatures of 53, 54, and as high as 55 degrees centigrade. It's 130 degrees Fahrenheit. And in an area that is already described by UN agencies as water stress, West Asia and South Asia as well. There's some evidence to indicate that the recent fires, the ongoing fires in Northern California, are also a result of climate change, since although they had a downpour in the spring, there was a huge growth in vegetation and greenery, and then a severe summer drought with, again, temperatures never seen, triple-digit temperatures in San Francisco, for example, long famous for the Mark Twain quote, coldest winter I've ever spent is a summer in San Francisco. Portland, triple-digit temperatures. Same thing in Seattle. So there was just a tinderbox there waiting to explode into this bonfire. And so West Asia is in acute water distress, as is South Asia. And there's a lot of evidence to point to the uprising in Syria being connected to climate change as well, because Syria had undergone a very severe drought 5 years, for 5 years before the March 2011 uprising against the Assad government. Tens of thousands of Syrian farmers abandoned their lands, went into the cities where there was no work, no housing or substandard housing and very little work, and then became, you know, ripe for an uprising against the government. So water is a hugely important issue that we've got to pay attention to, and, you know, part of what's happening with climate change. So India has literally gotten away with murder, not just in Kashmir, but in other parts of the country where there are what are called Maoist-inspired rebellions, in Chhattisgarh, in the south, in Orisha, in the northeast. The northeast itself has long been in rebellion against the Indian state. So there's all kinds of tensions within India that are pulling at it. And Kashmir is kind of the jewel in the crown for the Hindu nationalists. You can talk about other issues, but when you start talking about Kashmir, it hits them in their solar plexus. I kind of tell American audiences, Kashmir to the Hindu nationalists is what Israel is to the Zionists. You really cannot have a conversation about the issue because it's so emotional. It is so visceral and very difficult to persuade anyone of the facts that people don't like living under occupation. It's not pleasant, just as it's not pleasant to be bombed or be subjected to drone attacks, wedding parties being bombed. I mean, we talk about September 11th also in these very hushed tones. There's very little known to this day as to the, you know, reasons behind these kinds of attacks. Why is the war on terror proliferating? Why are there ISIS affiliates all over the place? No one had even heard of ISIS before 2003, 2004, 2005. Could it possibly, I'm just putting this out there as a wild guess, a wild speculation, could it possibly be related to U.S. policies in the Middle East? Gee, I don't know. Occupation, Israel occupying Palestine now in its 50th year. This year is also the 100th anniversary of the Balfour Declaration. Last year was the 100th anniversary of the Sykes-Picot Agreement, which effectively sliced and diced the Middle East into these little colonial enclaves, creating countries where no countries existed, like Kuwait, which was part of Iraq, and drawing, you know, artificial borders, splitting the Kurds up into various countries, Turkey, Iran, Iraq, and Syria, and basically creating the smorgasbord, which then the U.S. takes over in 1945 when Franklin D. Roosevelt, on his way back from Yalta, this is actually Valentine's Day, 1945, almost 2 months before FDR dies in Warm Springs, Georgia, he meets with three great leaders of democracy in the Middle East, Ibn Saud of Saudi Arabia, King Farouk of Egypt, and Emperor Haile Selassie of Ethiopia. I'm just going to talk about the meeting with Saud because that relates to what's going on today. At this meeting, Roosevelt made a deal with Ibn Saud to protect the kingdom militarily in exchange for unimpeded U.S. corporate access to Saudi oil fields. Cut the British and the French out. It's all going to be a U.S.-Saudi arrangement. And that was the devil's bargain that was struck on the USS Quincy, a destroyer in the Suez Canal in 1945. Roosevelt made a gift of a plane to Ibn Saud, and Ibn Saud gave a scimitar, loaded with diamonds and precious jewels. But that's been kind of one of the informing aspects of U.S. foreign policy. Mind you, this is 3 years before the creation of the State of Israel. So there was already a tremendous U.S. investment in the Middle East, and particularly focused, of course, on the oil fields, which we regarded as ours. It may be under the soil of these countries, but in fact, they belong to us. Mohammad Mossadegh in Iran, when he was overthrown by the CIA in 1953, destroying democracy in that country and bringing back the Shah and having 26 years of tyrannical rule under the Shah, the creation of the Sevak and the police state. Mohammad Mossadegh was probably, quite a problematic figure. He had been, educated at the Sorbonne. I don't think I have to say anything more. French education, must be thinking very rationally. And he had funny ideas that Iranian oil should benefit the people of Iran rather than the Anglo-Iranian Oil Corporation, where all the profits were going to London. They weren't going to benefit the Iranian people. Imagine that, Iranian oil belonging to the Iranian people. So for his forthright stand and nationalized oil, the CIA launched its first and maybe most successful Operation Ajax, led by Kermit Roosevelt, a grandson of Theodore Roosevelt and a cousin of FDR. He was the CIA leader of that CIA coup, and that overthrew democracy in Iran, and later was described in a CIA report as a classic example of blowback, the unintended consequences of U.S. foreign policy, throwing out Mossadegh and democracy, and bringing the Shah back and putting him on the peacock throne would lead to tremendous animosity and hostility toward the United States.